So I get to talk to you about the fun stuff, about what to do about Iraq and Iran. Now, on Iraq, many Obama supporters portray the Iraq war as the wrong war. And the big question is, how quickly can you get out of this wrong war? That has not been the main thrust of what Obama himself has said. And I would suggest it's unlikely to be the thrust of what he does as president. The thrust of what he has said is that we need a tough love approach towards the Iraq problem, and that what we have done by our large-scale presence in Iraq is given the Iraqis a get-out-of-jail-free card that they can avoid dealing with the difficult problems of their country and avoid building up their own capacities to solve their problems, and that it can instead rely upon us to solve their problems, and that furthermore, our large-scale and continuing presence has exacerbated the problems inside Iraq by feeding nationalist reactions. Now, this was the argument that he made 2 years ago with respect to the surge. And I would humbly suggest that that was largely wrong with regard to the question of how do we achieve security. It seemed like a very good argument. In fact, in many ways, it was the argument being made by the commanding generals who were responsible in Iraq and responsible for CENTCOM. And so at the time, it seemed like a very convincing argument. And indeed, I would, as I say, it was the one that was prevailing in the uniform military. The arguments about what we have to be doing is building up Iraqi forces and standing down as they stand up, and that the Iraqis have to finish this fight. It can't be our fight to finish, and that our large-scale presence was exacerbating the problem. And the sooner that we can stand up the Iraqis and hand over to them, the quicker this problem is going to be resolved. That was the strategy that Casey and Abzaid and Casey were following. And it turned out to be wrong. However, it is quite conceivable that that this strategy is correct about today's problem, which, as Obama has quite accurately analyzed, is that we aren't seeing political progress in Iraq that we want, and that on most of the significant political issues in Iraq, what we're seeing is instead deadlock and a failure to resolve issues. Issues which the Iraqi public, the Iraqi politicians all say ought to get resolved quickly, and really want to see compromise on, whether it's the oil law, whether it was the provincial elections, where there's still a bunch of difficult things that have to be resolved, or whether it's the status of Kirkuk. There's just lots of issues in Iraq where we aren't seeing the kind of difficult compromises, and the question is, what can we do to bring that about? And what Obama is suggesting is that we got to have a stick and not just a carrot. Now, he has spoken about how there will be a carrot as well. Namely, he has said repeatedly that if the Iraqis do more to resolve their problems, then we will do more to help them. And indeed, I suspect that will be the case. But it is an intriguing irony that on this issue, what do we have to do in order to get political progress inside Iraq, George Bush's approach is all carrot and Obama's approach is mostly stick. Now, this is going to be a really hard problem to solve. How can we influence the political evolution inside Iraq? Because we have to anticipate that after the heavy U.S. presence in Iraq in the last 5 years, that Iraqi politics is going to be dominated by hypernationalism, and that each Iraqi politician is going to be competing with the next one to see who can criticize the United States the most. You know, our British colleagues on our staff like to say, we've been there, we've gone through that with some countries, ex-colonies, and you have to anticipate that that's the way in which the politics is going to go. And so that puts us in a very difficult situation for influencing the political evolution. But that's what we want to do. And the hope is that the Obama administration will, through some holding this stake of saying, okay, you can't agree, well, we're out of here, you solve it, along with a carrot of if you do more, we'll do more, we'll be able to kickstart this process. And indeed, there seems to be very considerable interest across the Iraqi political spectrum in resolving a number of these problems. And lots of Iraqi political factions are sick and tired of the bickering and want these issues resolved. I mean, the progress in the on provincial elections was as much driven by a desire on the part of many of the Iraqi political factions to say, guys, we got to get this one done, as anything coming from the United States. The risk, of course, is that that Iraq will slip back into instability and that Iran will end up dominating Iraq. It is a real risk. But this Obama administration seems to be convinced that the only way we can get progress is if, in fact, we give a swift kick to the Iraqis to take on more of the challenges. That was Iraq. Iran. Iran and quite a different set of challenges. In Iran, the election of Obama has generated a lot of interest and excitement and enthusiasm, including in some surprising places. Today, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad sent a letter to Obama congratulating him on his victory, and it's really quite a respectful the tone of the letter is really quite respectful, and quite a hopeful letter of looking forward to being able to work together closely. He's also got lots of references about abandoning your policies, your policies of support for oppression of the last 60 years. But still, I would say that in a major U.S. effort to engage the Islamic Republic of Iran is inevitable, not only because candidate Obama talked about it. After all, from time to time, presidents have been known to do different things than they said they would do when they were candidates. But the more important reason why I suspect that a major effort to engage Iran is inevitable is because the United States has been simply unsuccessful at getting serious sticks to apply to Iran in the absence of engagement. And that there's just too much of a sense in the United States and around the world that we are at fault for the lack of progress on the Iran issue, and that we are not being reasonable. And that has been a major impediment to securing international agreement on further measures to pressure the Iranians. And so the United States is going to have to make a major effort to show that, in fact, it is prepared to do a lot to be very reasonable to the Iranians if we want to get broader worldwide support. And that only through that broader worldwide support do we have much prospect of getting Iran to compromise. That only if Iran becomes convinced that the world stands together against it are they likely to compromise. In other words, without the carrot, we're not going to get the stick. And without the combination of the carrot and stick, we're not going to get an agreement. I'm not guaranteed that we're going to get agreement if we engage, but I'm sure we won't unless we engage. However, there's going to be a lot of challenges with doing engagement. Let me just cite three major problems, traps that we have fallen into in the past, and which will be very difficult to avoid. First, I am often asked, what's wrong with trying? What harm can come from trying to engage Iran? I mean, all right, maybe it won't work, but what's wrong with trying? Answer, it can explode in our face. That is, after all, what happened the first two times that we made efforts to engage the Iranians. May I remind you that it was 29 years ago this month, in November 1st, 1979, that the National Security Advisor of the day, Zbigniew Brzezinski, met with Iran's Prime Minister, Foreign Minister, and Defense Minister in Algiers. And Brzezinski offered to deliver to Iran all of the arms that had been ordered under the Shah, and offered to continue the close U.S.-Iranian defense relationship and to work closely with the Islamic Republic. We have quite a detailed account of this recently, by the way, from Secretary of Defense Gates, who was the note-taker at the meeting. And he says that the Iranians weren't interested, they just wanted the Shah back. Well, unsuccessful meeting, what harm could come of it? The harm was that the next day, in all of the Iranian newspapers, there was the picture of Brzezinski shaking the hands of the Prime Minister Bazargan and meeting with the Foreign Minister and Defense Minister. And this led the radical students in what was then a broad coalition revolutionary movement with many different strands to think that these relatively moderate, non-clerical figures were conspiring with the United States to overthrow the revolution, similar to what had happened in 53 with their reading of how the United States had conspired with certain political leaders to overthrow Mossadegh. And so that evening, there was the first meeting planning what to do in response. And we know that there were three major student leaders there. Two of them said, we have to seize the American embassy. The third, Ahmadinejad, said, no, let's seize the Soviet embassy. They kicked him out of the room and continued their planning. And sure enough, on November 4th, they seized the American embassy. At the time, they said it was because of that meeting. In the memoirs they've written since, in the documents they've published since about their internal deliberations, it was because of the Brzezinski meeting they seized the embassy. Now, I would just suggest that the embassy seizure did not advance U.S.-Iranian relations. And it did not advance U.S. national interests. And it was a direct consequence of the Brzezinski initiative to engage the Iranians. You asked me what harm can come. I would suggest a lot. Well, building on that success, the next time a national security advisor got involved in meeting with Iranians at a high level, it was a former national security advisor, and you may recall, Bud McFarlane shows up in Tehran in a plane with a cake, with a Bible, and with a bunch of missiles in the Iran-Contra affair. I would just suggest that also was not a great advance in U.S.-Iranian relations, and it was not a great advance in U.S. national interests. So, two strikes from feeding the suspicions of those on the Iranian side about what it is that we're doing. And there's wonderful opportunities for us to have a third strike, because Iran's current leader, he's not the president, but is the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. This is a man who has spent the last 10 years telling us repeatedly that the greatest threat to Iran is a velvet revolution, that the greatest threat from Iran is overthrow from within, and that it will come because of Western powers engaging with civil society and using their cultural influence and their instruments of influence, like radio, in order to undermine the regime from within and to bring about a velvet revolution. Just to remember, in the velvet revolution unfolded extraordinarily quickly, really within a week, and that is what Khamenei is convinced is the principal threat to his regime. I commend to you our friend Karim Sajidpour's study at the Carnegie Endowment, laying this out in excruciating detail. And that is why Khamenei throws 68-year-old grandmother Hala Esfandiari into jail, seeing her as a vital threat to the Islamic Republic. That is why he throws George Soros' representative into jail and puts on Iranian television an hour-long show about the weekly meetings that George Soros and George Bush have at the White House to develop and advance their plan to overthrow the Islamic Republic. That is why the two doctors in Iran who have been so pioneering in developing treatment programs to deal with the rampaging AIDS problem that comes from that country's drug abuse, as they're headed off to Mexico City to receive the award from the World's Aid Session, whatever it was, last August, get thrown in jail and have not been heard from since, because they were plotting a velvet revolution. It's not going to be easy to engage with this guy without raising his suspicions of what it is that we're doing. And he could well decide that this is a grave risk to his regime, and we could face a grave setback to U.S.-Iranian relations from an effort to engage if what we do is exacerbate hardline paranoia. Now, paradoxically, simultaneously, we could also undermine reformers. Because what we could do is suggest that a hard line has led the United States to come crawling on its knees and do something it said it wouldn't do. And that all Iran has to do is maintain a hard line, and the West makes more generous offers. The West said it wouldn't talk to Iran and or wouldn't negotiate with Iran until there was a suspension of Iran's enrichment, and here it is. This just suggests that the longer Iran waits, the better a deal it'll get from the West. So we could be in the very unfortunate situation. And by the way, this latter worry is something which I've heard a great deal about from European diplomats. They're absolutely petrified that what they have been doing has led to this attitude on the part of the Iranians, and that the Americans are going to come along and reinforce that attitude. And has led George Perkovich at the Carnegie Endowment, not exactly a raving right-wing lunatic, to suggest that, in fact, what we ought to be saying to the Iranians is that we will be taking away the offers that we make each month unless you come to a deal with us soon. That we've got to turn this dynamic around and say to the Iranians, come to a deal soon or else. And so we could have a situation in which we have the worst of all possible worlds. The hardliners say, see, we told you, we were right. The great Satan has to come to us with concessions, and if we just wait, oh, and by the way, those concessions that they're making and that engagement they're making is designed to overthrow us and to undermine us, and therefore we should refuse it. So we end up helping the hardliners and, meanwhile, not getting the engagement we want. Then, on top of all this, by offering to engage with Iran, we could create grave doubts among our friends and allies. To start with the French, it would be quite reasonable for people in Paris to worry that what the United States is doing is acting like a lone cowboy and going off there and taking over an initiative which has, after all, been in European hands now for 5 years, and taking it over and trying to solve it itself and cutting them out of the process. It would also be not surprising if our friends in the Gulf Cooperation Council were worried that the United States was, in fact, following through on the advice that you hear frequently from pundits of this town, that Iran is the real strategic prize in the area, we ought to figure out some way to have a relationship with the Iranians, and who needs the Saudis anyway? And they could decide that they need to develop their own plans independent of the United States. They need to accommodate Iran, or they need to acquire their own special weapons, or maybe do both. And then, of course, our Israeli friends may also be very worried about what we're doing. But let me emphasize, they will not be the only ones. That, indeed, I would suspect that, partly because of the strength of our relationship, I would suspect that our GCC friends and countries like France will be at least as paranoid about what we're doing as the Israelis. So this is going to be really tough to do. Really tough to do. I think it's essential. I think we have to do it. But boy, I'm glad I'm not working on it.